groupings of a single tree species were very rare, and after identifying one tree, the men could search for hours before finding another of the same kind. The trees themselves were often strange and complex, characterized by huge buttresses, flowering trunks, or apparent branches that plunged back into the earth, or were wrapped in enormous looped or curled vines. Most important, other than insects, which teemed everywhere, the forest seemed virtually empty, with little or no sign or sound of any inhabitants. These odd characteristics were not mere natural curiosities or local quirks, but direct reflections of the deadly, exquisitely efficient competition for survival that was taking place all around Roosevelt and his men. They also reflected the profound impact of that evolutionary competition on all forms of life in the Amazon, where it has produced some of the most phenomenally diverse and specialized plants and creatures anywhere on Earth. While the process of evolution has continuously altered and selected the features of life everywhere on the planet, in few places have its workings been as conspicuous or its results as refined as in the Amazon. The extraordinary range of forms that characterizes the Amazon rainforest has been attributed to many causes, all of which are likely to have played some role in creating the immense cornucopia of living things that surrounded the expedition. Perhaps the most frequently cited factor in the species richness of the Amazon is the region's latitude, which has for millions of years produced generally stable temperatures and moist environmental conditions that have favored the uninterrupted development of the jungle and its inhabitants. Another prominent explanation is the repeated isolation and reconnection of the jungle to other continents and habitats over the broad sweep of time. Whereas some regions, such as Africa, have undergone fewer changes and reflect a comparatively lower number of unique plant and animal species, the South American continent has at different points been cut off from or rejoined to other landmasses. The separation of South America from the rest of Gondwanaland, for example, created opportunities for the development of new indigenous species. That isolation was then interrupted by the rise of the Panamanian land bridge, which permitted the arrival of new species from North America and started new rounds of selection. Within the Amazon itself, some scientists believe, localized changes of climate created shifting patterns of so-called refugia, or rainforest pockets, where isolation offered unusual opportunities for the emergence of specialized plants, birds, insects, and other animals. New variants of life, particularly fish life, were also fostered by the long presence of an inland sea at the heart of the continent. Distinct new species are also thought to have emerged within enclaves set off by natural boundaries such as mountains and, of course, the channels and tributaries of the giant Amazon River system itself. As in the development of a modern economy, with its ever-increasing specialization of labor and markets, each increase in competition among the inhabitants of the rainforest has itself been a powerful source of further speciation, rewarding entrepreneurial variations of life that can exploit skills and opportunities that previously went unrecognized or did not exist. In the presence of such highly refined evolutionary pressures, every natural advantage and source of potential sustenance becomes an object of competition and is consequently used to its fullest. Despite the lush green vistas and overgrown shores that the expedition could see from the river, for example, the soil of many lowland rainforests is not rich or fecund, but rather has adapted to recycle nutrients with extraordinary speed. The same abundant precipitation and steady temperatures that support life also leach minerals from the soil, and intense tree and plant growth exploits every available nutrient, leaving the floor of many tropical jungles, including the Amazon, permanently hovering at the margin of exhaustion. For plants and trees, competition for available soil nutrients is paired with competition for sunlight, which is essential for the photosynthesis that green plants use to create carbohydrates from carbon dioxide and water. Every kind of plant or tree therefore represents a unique trade-off between the quest for water and soil nutrients on one hand, and the quest for sunlight on the other. Soaring more than 150 feet above Roosevelt's head and out of sight in the green canopy were giant emergent tree species that had secured their survival by putting all their resources into the effort to outrace their competitors to the sunshine. For fast-growing trees, the trade-off for speed is inadequate defenses against insects and vulnerability to storms that cannot reach the lower, more sheltered layers of the forest. Unable to sink deep roots in the thin forest floor, canopy trees are also generally obliged to develop elaborate support systems at their base, either with giant triangular buttresses that surround the bole or tree trunk, or so-called flying buttresses that look like inverted branches. On the forest floor, where the sky is all but obscured by such tall canopy trees, smaller plants or trees with limited resources must develop increasingly refined strategies to find a place in the sun. The most obvious of these strategies is to avoid the cost of building a structure capable of reaching the canopy by simply climbing a tree that has already done so. This opportunistic strategy, adopted by vines and lianas, can permit a newcomer to remain anchored in the forest floor while growing rapidly to the canopy. But since even vine construction requires substantial resources, it entails complex choices about which tree to climb, a requirement that has produced astonishingly sophisticated traits. Some Amazonian plants, for example, can shift as necessary between tree-like form when they receive sunlight and a climbing vine when they find themselves in shade. Others can transform themselves into trees once they reach the canopy, abandoning their host and winding their viney stems together into a trunk. While most plants naturally seek the sun, other Amazonian vines have adapted to seek out the dark bases of large canopy trees that might offer reliable support, and only then to turn upward toward the light. With an alacrity that can seem almost human, rainforest vines send out tendrils that reach out delicately to encounter a potential host, then curl to grasp it once it is found. A principal risk of the vine strategy is the danger that the host tree will sway and break the vine. So many vine species have adapted by developing slack in the form of elaborate loops, curls, and coils, lending the rainforest the distinctive draping character that Roosevelt could so easily see and admire. Another adaptation to this and other dangers is for the vine simply to abandon its connection to the ground and to derive its water and nutrients entirely in the canopy, becoming an air plant or epiphyte, a category of plant that has generated literally thousands of species, including bromeliads and orchids. After establishing themselves in the canopy, some epiphytes, in their turn, then reverse the entire process, sending aerial roots downward to establish a connection to the forest floor. In reaction to the attempts of freeloading vines and epiphytes to benefit from their hard-won position in the canopy and to protect themselves from being shaded over by such parasites, trees have developed many protection methods of their own. Some have developed smooth bark that keeps tendrils from attaching, and still others have adapted to slough off bark, leaves, or indeed entire branches to send epiphytes and vines crashing to the forest floor. Throughout the jungle, moreover, trees have adapted to prevent multiple deaths from tree falls or blights by separating themselves at regular distances from trees of the same species. From his vantage point on the shaded forest floor, Roosevelt stood far below much of this unceasing evolutionary combat. Crowded with broad-leaved trees, crowning vines, and epiphytes, as well as the hundreds of insects and animal species that rely upon them, the upper canopy is difficult to see from the ground, except in the roof-like function that its name implies. By shading everything below it, the canopy helps to obscure much of the activity that takes place in the understory or middle level, of the rainforest. Its shading action also contributes importantly to the relative absence of undergrowth on the forest floor, where the men of the expedition found that they could move about with surprising ease. While sunlight from the open river made the shoreline an almost impassable wall of trees, vines, and dense underbrush, once that barrier was breached, the dark interior of the jungle, broken only by occasional gaps in the canopy and a scattered, speckled light, revealed a labyrinth of tree trunks and vines, but little else. As the men of the expedition arose and started their morning routine, Roosevelt was able to admire the complexity of the jungle before him, but could only guess at the mysteries that it held beyond his view. So complex and interdependent was the ecosystem he and his men had entered, that the jungle itself could appear to take on the attributes of a living being. If Roosevelt had been able to see the rainforest from a distance, he could have watched it breathe. As the trees transpire, or, in a sense, sweat, they pump water into the atmosphere from their leaves. In the warm air, the water quickly evaporates and is recycled as rain. As the ex-president stood at the river's edge, surveying the jungle he hoped to master and explore, the forest surrounding him met the dawn by exhaling thin white clouds of condensing moisture that rose over the canopy above him, like the breath of a wolf on a winter morning. As he had during his telegraph line expeditions, Rondon approached the camp routine on the River of Doubt with military formality. To the task he brought not only strict discipline, but even pomp and ceremony. Every morning the men would gather in front of their Brazilian commander, who was dressed in his army khakis, to hear his orders of the day, laid out as formally as if he were addressing a regiment at war. Then, after a search through the surrounding forest for a piece of hardwood that would make a suitable marker, they would smooth one side of the wood with an adze, paint the camp number and the date on it, and drive it into the forest floor. They knew that rain, sun, and insects would likely destroy the markers long before they would be discovered by anyone who could read them, but they felt compelled nonetheless to leave behind a historical record of their journey. This routine, which they planned to carry out every morning until they reached the mouth of the River of Doubt, was more than an empty ritual. It was a tangible connection to civilization and a constant reminder of who they were and why they were there. Rondon had learned through excruciating hardship how important routine, discipline, and military ritual were in maintaining morale during an expedition into the Amazon. Even on his 1909 journey, when he and all of his men nearly starved to death, Rondon had never deviated from his routine. "The ragged bugler had his bugle," Roosevelt wrote, recording the last traumatic days of the expedition as Rondon described them to him. "Lieutenant Pyrenees had lost every part of his clothing except a hat and a pair of drawers. The half-naked lieutenant drew up his 11 fever patients in line, the bugle sounded, everyone came to attention, and the haggard colonel read out the orders of the day." As important as Rondon's routine had proved to be during a crisis, however, it could also appear inflexible and dogmatic to his men. Rondon expected the same rigorous discipline from his soldiers that he demanded from himself, and his was not an easy model to live up to. The colonel still woke at 4 o'clock every morning and swam in whatever pond or river was nearby. He shaved without a mirror and had a simple breakfast, never allowing himself any indulgences, even if he had access to them. He never drank alcohol or allowed his men to do so, and he even abstained from coffee, drinking only water or herbal tea. Roosevelt, in contrast, was much more flexible than his co-commander and, as a result, better liked. Roosevelt had endured some cold nights hunting down runaway cattle in the Dakota Badlands, and he had led a regiment to war. But he had never had to bring a band of starving, desperate men out of the jungle. Even on this expedition, he was more figurehead than commander, and when there were decisions to be made, he deferred to Rondon. Roosevelt's job had, in a way, become that of expedition raconteur. He regaled the men every night with stories of his days in the Wild West or on the African savannah. He was, Rondon wrote, the life of the party. In contrast to the reserved, taciturn Brazilian colonel, Roosevelt must have seemed peculiarly fun and light-hearted. Rondon himself was stunned by his loquacious co-commander. "And talk," he wrote. "I never saw a man who talked so much. He would talk all of the time he was in swimming, all of the time during meals, traveling in the canoe and at night around the campfire. He talked endlessly and on all conceivable subjects." Although they had risen well before dawn, it was almost noon by the time Roosevelt, Cherry, Dr. Cajazeira, and their three paddlers finally climbed into their dugout on the morning of February 28th and headed off down the river in pursuit of the rest of the expedition, which had left camp nearly 4 hours earlier. Sympathetic to how difficult it had been, and likely would continue to be, for his naturalist to collect specimens for the museum while they were on the River of Doubt, Roosevelt had ordered the other two dugouts and two balsas to go ahead without them when Cherry heard some bird calls near camp that morning. Cherry had made it worth Roosevelt's while, capturing 6 birds, including a red-headed woodpecker and a brilliant turquoise-blue cotinga. Once back on the Twisting River, Roosevelt and Cherry resumed their search for signs of life. Hour after hour passed, however, and their efforts were rewarded only by a few deserted game trails, an otter splashing across the river, and 2 tropical birds called guans. His face cast in shadow beneath his deep sun helmet, Roosevelt watched as the jungle glided past him, its towering trees and blue sky reflected like a trembling inverted world in the water's dark surface. He drank in the rich array of beauty, admiring the many colored butterflies that fluttered over the river, and marveling at how a spark of sunlight could cloak the electric green jungle. "When the sun broke through rifts in the clouds," he wrote, "his shafts turned the forest to gold." Despite the beauty they were witnessing, nearly constant rain and an onslaught of insects made the men miserable. The Amazon basin gets as much as 100 inches of rain each year, 3 times as much as New York City. The rainforest itself generates 60% of the precipitation through the transpiration process, and most of it falls during the months of March and April. The temperature was consistently high, usually in the mid to high 80s, but the heat was powerless to counteract the effects of the relentless rain. "There would be a heavy downpour," Kermit wrote. "Then out would come the sun, and we would be steamed dry, only to be drenched once more a half hour later." The forest either steamed with thick humidity or sagged under a heavy downpour. Rain drummed on the river, ran off their hats, dripped down their backs, and pooled in their shoes. It soaked their tents and filled their canoes. Their clothes hung in heavy, clinging folds, and they never completely dried. "Our clothes were usually wet when we took them off at night and just as wet when we put them on again in the morning," Roosevelt wrote. Within a few days, they would all forget what it felt like to pull on a dry pair of socks. Compounding the misery wrought by the rain was an overarching sense of isolation and uncertainty, a feeling that was magnified by strange noises that shattered the forest's silence and set the men's nerves on edge. That afternoon, as Roosevelt and the men in his dugout paddled quietly down the river, a long, deep shriek suddenly ripped through the jungle. It was the roar of a howler monkey, one of the loudest cries of any animal on earth. The sound, which can be heard from 3 miles away, is formed when the monkey forces air through its large, hollow hyoid bone, which sits between its lower jaw and voice box, and anchors its tongue. The result is a deep, resonating howl that vibrates through the forest with strange, inhuman intensity, and echoes so pervasively that its location can be nearly impossible to identify. Worse even than the noises they could recognize, were those that none of them could explain. These strange sounds, which disappeared as quickly as they came and were a mystery even to those who knew the rainforest best, had made a strong impression on the British naturalist Henry Walter Bates 50 years earlier. Often, even in the still hours of midday, a sudden crash will be heard resounding afar through the wilderness, as some great bough or entire tree falls to the ground, the naturalist wrote. There are, besides, many sounds which it is impossible to account for. I found the natives generally as much at a loss in this respect as myself. Sometimes a sound is heard like the clang of an iron bar against a hard, hollow tree, or a piercing cry rends the air. These are not repeated, and the succeeding silence tends to heighten the unpleasant impression which they make on the mind. There was activity all around the men, both human and animal, but they could not see it, and they could only guess at what it was. This blindness left them uniquely vulnerable as they fought their way through a tangled swath of submerged trees that evening, hacking and hewing, Roosevelt wrote, in search of dry ground for their second camp. This was a different kind of fear altogether, something that even their grueling, worry-plagued overland journey had not prepared them for, and no man seemed immune to the change in mood that occurred as the river carried them ever deeper into the jungle. The Amazon's sudden, inexplicable sounds were especially terrifying at night, when they were all in the pitch-black forest, with no way to see a potential attacker, and no sure means of escape. While the jungle in daylight could sometimes appear completely devoid of inhabitants, the nightly cacophony left no doubt that the men of the expedition were not alone. Even for veteran outdoorsmen like George Cherry, the setting of the sun came to mark an unnerving threshold between the relative familiarity of a long day on the river and sleepless nights in the jungle, spent trying to imagine the source of the spine-chilling noises that echoed in the darkness around him. "Frequently at night, with my camp at the edge of the jungle," he wrote, "I have lain in my hammock listening, my ears yearning for some familiar sound, every sense alert, nerves taut. Strange things have happened in the night." The screams, crashes, clangs, and cries of the long Amazon night were all the more disturbing because they often provoked apparent terror among the unseen inhabitants of the jungle themselves. In the fathomless canyons of tree trunks and the shrouds of black vines that surrounded the men at night, the hum and chatter of thousands of nocturnal creatures would snap into instant silence in response to a strange noise, leaving the men to wait in breathless apprehension of what might come next. "Let there be the least break in the harmony of sound," Cherry observed, "and instantly there succeeds a death-like silence, while all living things wait in dread for the inevitable shriek that follows the night prowler's stealthy spring." Chapter 13. On the Ink-Black River. From the moment they launched their boats upon the River of Doubt, Roosevelt and his men knew that the river would be their only guide. Even when they were on land, hunting, portaging, or making camp for the night, they would never stray far from its shores. They needed it for drinking water, cooking, and bathing. They needed it to escape from the oppressive heat of the rainforest, which clung to them like a wet wool blanket. Most of all, they needed it to carry them home. As important as the river was to the expedition, however, it was a capricious and unreliable ally. Like many South American rivers, the River of Doubt could change character quickly and dramatically over a very short distance, and with profound consequences for an expedition. Swollen and swift during the rainy season, it was cluttered with dangerous debris and pocked with shifting whirlpools that could flip a canoe and trap a man under the surface of the water in a matter of seconds. Even more complex and dangerous than the river itself were the fishes, mammals, and reptiles that inhabited it. Like the rainforest that surrounds and depends upon it, the Amazon River system is a prodigy of speciation and diversity, serving as home to more than 3,000 species of freshwater fishes, more than any other river system on Earth. Its waters are crowded with creatures of nearly every size, shape, and evolutionary adaptation, from tiny neon tetras to thousand-pound manatees to pink freshwater boto dolphins to stingrays to armor-plated catfishes to bull sharks. By comparison, the entire Missouri and Mississippi River system that drains much of North America has only about 375 fish species. Able to swim freely through large swaths of the jungle during the rainy season, for example, certain Amazonian fish, such as the tambaqui, have evolved teeth that look like sheep molars and are tough enough to crack open even the hard, cannonball-sized shell of the Brazil nut. The ancient eel-like South American lungfish has lungs as well as gills. Unless it surfaces every 4 to 10 minutes for a gulp of air, it will drown. During the dry season, however, while other fishes around it die as the ponds and streams dry up, the lungfish survives by burrowing into the mud and taking oxygen from the air. Still another species, the so-called four-eyed fish, has eyes that are divided in two at the waterline by a band of tissue. With two separate sets of corneas and retinas, the fish can search for predators in the sky above and at the same time look for danger in the water below. Many of these strange adaptations are geared toward self-defense. Others are designed to help the fish become better, faster, smarter predators. There are electric fishes that eat nothing but the tails of other electric fish, which can regenerate their appendages, thus ensuring the predator a limitless food supply. Other fish have evolved to eat prey that live outside of their own immediate ecosystem. The 3-foot-long arowana, for example, has a huge mouth and a bony tongue and can leap twice its body length. Nicknamed the water monkey, it snatches large insects, reptiles, and even small birds from the low branches of overhanging trees. The riverine creatures that the members of the expedition were most interested in, however, were those that were dangerous to man. The most visible threats were the 15-foot-long black caimans, which lay low near their nest of rotting debris and vanished into the water as the expedition's canoes passed by. Cherry, in particular, had great respect for the South American alligator. He had nearly lost his life to one while on an expedition on the Orinoco. The river had been low, and the mudflat that bordered it studded with flat, exposed stones. He was stepping from stone to stone, his mind and eyes on the birds that lined the river, when he suddenly felt an impulse to look down. In mid-stride, with his foot still dangling in the air, he realized that he was just about to step not on a stone, but on the back of a large caiman. "Had I done so," he later wrote, "the creature would have instantly whirled about and had me in his jaws before I could possibly have escaped." The river's other inhabitants were largely invisible from the expedition's dugouts, but the fact that they could not be seen only heightened the oppressive sense of danger they instilled in the men. Aboard their crude, heavily loaded boats, they sat at most just 6 inches above the water and courted danger whenever one of them dangled his foot overboard or trailed his fingers in the current. If one of their boats tipped over in a whirlpool or rapid, the men would find themselves dumped into the middle of the river with no option but a frightening swim to shore. Launching and landing the boats, often chest-deep in water amid the heavy underbrush that lined the riverbank, the men were constantly vulnerable to the predatory fish, waterborne snakes, and other creatures they were disturbing. Even the mundane necessity of bathing was a source of ongoing concern, although in the mud and sweltering jungle heat, the men grew willing to take their chances. Roosevelt himself cooled off in the river at every opportunity. Floating in the shallow water near the bank, the 220-pound former president looked to Rondon like some sort of a great fat fish which had come to the surface, defying the dangers that surrounded him. The fish that inspired the greatest fear among the men was the piranha. Attracted by blood and drawn to the kind of commotion that a bathing man might make, piranha have been known to swim in groups of more than 100, spreading out to scout for prey and then alerting the others, probably by sound, when they find it. Of the approximately 20 piranha species, Most prefer to attack something their own size or smaller, and they are happy to scavenge, especially during the rainy season, when there is more to choose from. However, their muscular jaws and saw-like teeth, which look as if they have been filed to tiny spear points, can make quick work of a living creature of any size and strength, from a water bird to a monkey to even an ox. During telegraph line expeditions, Rondon and his soldiers regularly offered up their weakest ox to a school of piranha so that the rest of their herd could safely cross a river. Even Rondon, who had faced down mutinous soldiers and ridden on horseback into hostile Indian territory, showed extreme caution when bathing in the river. Having seen his co-commander barefoot, Roosevelt could easily guess at the reason. One morning during a telegraph line expedition, Rondon had found a shallow pool to bathe in at the edge of a river. He had carefully inspected it first, but the moment he slipped a foot into the water, a piranha had attacked, clipping off one of his toes with a single bite. More painful to Rondon was the loss of a friend to piranhas in 1904. While crossing a river on a wounded mule, the man who, like Rondon, had been a top cadet at the military academy, was attacked by piranhas drawn to the mule's blood. By the time his companions found him, there was nothing left on his skeleton but the feet in his boots. Roosevelt referred to piranha as the fish that eats men when it can get the chance. By the time he had reached the River of Doubt, he had heard dozens of horrifying stories of piranha that had left nothing but white bones on a riverbed after seizing upon a wounded soldier or an unfortunate child. Astounded by their bloodlust, he called the fish ferocious little monsters, and his vivid retelling of catching them on the Paraguay River caused a sensation in the United States when his Scribner's articles began to hit the newsstands. The piranha's rabid, furious snaps drive the teeth through flesh and bone, he wrote. The head with its short muzzle, staring malignant eyes, and gaping, cruelly armed jaws is the embodiment of evil ferocity, and the actions of the fish exactly match its looks. I never witnessed an exhibition of such impotent savage fury as was shown by the piranhas as they flapped on deck. When fresh from the water and thrown on the boards, they uttered an extraordinary squealing sound. As they flapped about, they bit with vicious eagerness at whatever presented itself. One of them flapped into a cloth and seized it with a bulldog grip. Another grasped one of its fellows, another snapped at a piece of wood, and left the teeth marks deep therein. Piranha had already left their teeth marks on several members of Roosevelt's own expedition. They had bitten off part of one of Leo Miller's hands while he and Cherry were collecting in the Gran Chaco during Roosevelt's speaking tour. Suddenly I heard an outburst of considerable profanity, Cherry later recalled. And he, Miller, came running to show me his hand, from which a good-sized piece had been torn by a piranha, the most bloodthirsty inhabitant of tropical waters. Cherry himself had been nearly devoured alive on another expedition, when he had fallen from a tree branch and landed in the middle of a piranha feeding frenzy, a frenzy that he had incited by tossing into the river pieces of another piranha that he had caught earlier in the day. Even years after the incident, Cherry shuddered at the memory of that extraordinarily close call. As I fell, I made a wild grab at the limb, and in so doing, I struck my arm against a small projection, tearing a long gash in the flesh. Even in the fraction of a second it took me to fall, I realized that I was bleeding and that my blood would instantly incite an attack by the murderous fish. To be sure, the bank was only a few yards distant, but the lightning-like rapidity of the piranha left me little chance to escape unhurt. My whole instinct was to strike out instantly for the shore. Even a poor swimmer would have made it in a dozen strokes. But I retained enough of my reason to know that my one chance of escape lay in keeping the fish at bay before they became crazed with the taste of blood. So not only did I strike out for the shore, but I set up a violent motion of twisting and splashing with my arms and legs. Even then I felt a blow and a sharp pain in my shoulder that told me one of the fish had struck. All I could do was to continue my furious splashing. Luckily, I succeeded in reaching the shore, though badly bitten, before I dragged myself out of the water. The physical effort of my contortions had exhausted me. It was some time before I could get up strength enough to start back to camp. I still bear the scars of that encounter. And I know that had I been even slightly stunned by my fall, I should never have lived to tell the tale. As terrifying as the piranha were, many of those who lived in the settled areas of the Amazon would have preferred them to the tiny, almost transparent catfish known as the candiru. This sharp-spined fish is the only other animal besides the vampire bat that is known to survive solely on blood. Most species of candiru are only about an inch long, and they usually make their living by swimming into the gill chambers of larger fish. To other fish, the candiru is relatively harmless, because when full to capacity, it simply swims back out of the gill chamber and burrows into a riverbed to digest its blood meal. To humans, however, the miniature catfish is a potentially lethal menace. When it comes to parasitizing people, a very rare occurrence, the candiru's modus operandi is to enter through an orifice, from a vagina to an anus. It is most famous, however, for wiggling its way into a urethra. The most widely discussed, if highly controversial, theory is that candirus are attracted to urine streams, mistaking them for the gill streams of fish. Before the unsuspecting bather knows what is happening, the candiru has followed the stream to its source, slipped inside, sunk its spines into the soft tissue, and begun to gorge on its host's blood. For the candiru, this is a fatal move. While it can easily swim out of a fish's gills, it cannot find its way out of a human urethra. Even if it could swim backward, its stiff spines prevent it from going in any direction but forward. For the person whom the candiru has parasitized, the situation is potentially just as dire, and the cure can be as bad as the affliction. The candiru soon dies where it is, but its body continues to block the urethra, causing excruciating pain, and if not removed, death. Candiru removal, however, is difficult, especially in the remote tropics. In 1897, Georges Boulanger, a Belgian ichthyologist and herpetologist, presented a candiru to the Zoological Society of London and related a gruesome story told to him by a doctor named Bach of the extreme measures to which men in outlying villages were willing to go in order to rid themselves of a candiru. "The only means of preventing it from reaching the bladder, where it causes inflammation and ultimately death, is to instantly amputate the penis," Boulanger told his no doubt horrified audience. Dr. Bach had actually examined a man and three boys with amputated penises as a result of this dreadful incident. Dr. Bach was later discredited because he had not personally witnessed either the attacks or the amputations. But his was not the first or the last story of a penectomy performed on a man whose urethra had been blocked by a candiru. The potential danger for the men on the River of Doubt came not just when they swam in the river, but even when they urinated in its shallow waters. Instances of candirus parasitizing people are rare, but in the one case in which a doctor fully documented his removal of a candiru from a young man, the victim's explanation of how the fish had entered his urethra was nearly as shocking as the fact that it was there at all. Up to that point, most scientists had assumed that in order for the fish to find its way into a urethra, that part of the victim's anatomy had to be submerged in the water. In this case, however, the victim reported that just before the attack, he had been standing in a river urinating, but the water had reached only to his upper thighs, and his penis had not even touched the river, much less been submerged in it. The candiru, he claimed, had abruptly leapt out of the water, shimmied up his urine stream, and disappeared into his urethra. He had made a desperate lunge for the fish, but it was too fast and too slippery. The incident occurred in a small town more than 100 miles from Manaus, and the local doctors had been at a loss to help the man. By the time he was finally moved to Manaus for treatment, he had been unable to urinate for more than a week, and his stomach had become so distended that he looked 6 months pregnant. The doctor who eventually operated on him was able to successfully remove the candiru without resorting to amputation. On the morning of March 1st, the expedition's third day on the River of Doubt, the survey canoes once again got an early start, and the rest of the expedition followed around 11 a.m. The rain began almost as soon as they shoved off the bank. Carried relentlessly forward by the swift current, the boats had just started to round a bend when the forested riverbank on both sides abruptly began to change. Out of the mist and rain, a collection of clearly man-made structures materialized before them. And the men suddenly realized that they were being propelled, without warning or preparation, into the middle of an Indian village. With no opportunity to retreat, and dangerously exposed, they braced themselves in their low-riding dugouts. As they moved swiftly toward the village, however, they could see that it showed no signs of activity. Perched on both banks of the river, the village appeared to be devoid of life. Its population had vanished, and the jungle had already begun to reclaim the land. The palm-thatched roofs on the huts were rotting, and what appeared to have been small cultivated areas were overgrown, studded, Roosevelt wrote, with the burned skeletons of trees. At the river's edge, a fish trap bobbed in the current, little left beyond a few hewn sticks to distinguish it from the mass of vegetation growing on the banks. Around another bend in the river lay the remains of a bridge that dangled a couple of feet above the water, just a few stout poles that had been driven into the riverbed, and a long rope of liana that had been twisted for strength and stretched from one bank to the other to form a handrail. The rest of the bridge was gone, swept away by the swollen river. The village, the first sign of human life that they had seen since launching their boats, was irrefutable proof that Indians lived on the banks of the River of Doubt. While this knowledge doubtless thrilled Rondon, it must have been sobering to the rest of the men in the expedition. They had no way to know if these Indians were hostile, but for the sake of their own safety, and judging by the Nambikara's initial reaction to Rondon, they had to assume that they were. In fact, Rondon speculated that these Indians were a subgroup of the Nambikara called the Navaite. Rondon nominally had a treaty with the Nambikara, but there was no reason to believe that this group would honor that treaty, or even that they knew anything about it or Rondon. The only certainty was that, if they were still alive, the Indians who once lived in this village would see the expedition before the members of the expedition would see them. There was nothing to explain why the Indians had deserted their village. Perhaps they had moved into the interior as the river began to rise, or had found better land for planting or hunting elsewhere, and so set out to establish a new home. But they also could have been massacred by another tribe, or even another group within their own tribe. Whatever the explanation, on this gray day, with the light dwindling in the silent forest, the village had the eerie unease of a ghost town, the dwelling place of spirits, rather than of men of flesh and bone. The gloom of the day's events lifted somewhat when Cherry, from his seat in Roosevelt's canoe, heard the very real and tantalizingly close sound of game. His ears, an ornithologist's most finely tuned collecting tool, caught the distinctive yuck, yuck of the woolly monkey coming from the branches of a tree just overhead. Woolly monkeys are highly intelligent, extremely sensitive animals. In captivity, they have even been known to weep when upset. But when Cherry raised his rifle, took aim, and fired, he was not thinking about adding an interesting specimen to his museum collection. He was thinking about dinner. Moments later, a monkey with dense gray fur, a long prehensile tail, and a round, protruding belly pitched forward and fell heavily out of the trees. As they watched the monkey tumble through the branches, the men briefly forgot their worries and concentrated on the prospect of fresh meat for dinner. Their excitement, however, nearly turned to catastrophe a few hours later when, in their haste to make camp, they forgot one of the most fundamental rules of the rainforest. Watch your step. With their dinner in hand, the men searched for a dry stretch of shore on which they could spend the night. Finally, finding a level spot a few feet above the river, they landed, moored their boats to some trees, and began clearing a site for their third camp. As usual, they did not venture far from the water's edge, but what they did not realize that night was that the brush they were clearing concealed a coral snake. Of all the creatures of the rainforest, none are more reliably lethal to man than snakes. Naturalists complain that venomous snakes are hard to find in the jungle. They disappear in a mat of branches and leaves, or hide beneath a fallen tree. But they are there. And when they strike, they are deadly. The most infamous of South America's poisonous snakes are the ringed coral snake and the pit viper. A relative of North American rattlesnakes and copperheads, pit vipers have long horizontal fangs that snap into place like switchblades when they are ready to strike. Within seconds, their victims begin to sweat, vomit, and swell. Death comes from renal failure or intracranial bleeding. In 1931, Clodomiro Picado, a Costa Rican biologist and snake bite expert, described the horrors of a pit viper bite. Moments after being bitten, the man feels a live fire germinating in the wound, as if red-hot tongs contorted his flesh. That which was mortified enlarges to monstrosity, and lividness invades him. The unfortunate victim watches his body becoming a corpse, piece by piece. A chill of death invades all his being, and soon bloody threads fall from his gums, and his eyes, without intending to, will also cry blood, until, beaten by suffering and anguish, he loses the sense of reality. The coral snake, which lurked under the brush as Roosevelt and his men waded ashore to make camp that night, had venom as deadly as that of the pit viper. A member of the Elapidae family, which includes cobras and mambas, the coral snake is not as aggressive as a pit viper and has much shorter fangs, but its venom is just as potent and certainly as painful. Once injected, the venom immediately attacks the victim's nervous system, causing excruciating and irreversible paralysis. Eventually, the respiratory system collapses, and the victim, acutely aware of what is happening to him, slowly suffocates to death. So lethal is the bite of a coral snake that, in rural Brazil at the time of Roosevelt's expedition, local people did not even attempt to treat it. No anti-venom existed, and the moment someone was bitten, he was given up for dead. In North America, naturalists use an old adage, red touching yellow, dangerous fellow, to help distinguish between non-venomous snakes and the lethal coral snake, with its distinctive black, red, and yellow bands. This adage, however, is useless in the Amazon, where many of the more than 50 species of coral snakes have red and yellow bands that do not touch, but are deadly nevertheless. While the camaradas noisily cleared a space in the overgrown shoreline for their campsite, they at first did not notice the 3-foot-long coral snake, which had darted out of its hiding place. As their calloused and dirt-streaked bare feet moved upon the thin layer of leaf litter, the snake slithered by, growing increasingly agitated. When threatened, a coral snake thrashes its body and tail, often in prelude to an attack. Perhaps it was this whip-like movement that finally attracted the attention of one of the camaradas, just as he was about to plant his foot squarely on the venomous snake. Terrified, the man grabbed an axe and swung wildly, driving the snake away from his feet and toward Roosevelt. Roosevelt reacted quickly, although perhaps not with his usual athletic grace. Despite his 220 pounds avoirdupois, Cherry later recalled, he, Roosevelt, did a much livelier dance in attempting to set his foot on the snake than he did when he danced the hornpipe on shipboard. When Roosevelt's foot finally came thundering down, it missed its mark, crushing the snake's body rather than its lethal head. Rearing back, the snake attacked. Roosevelt, still wearing his heavy hobnailed boots, watched as the snake's short fangs plunged into the tough leather and spilled its venom down the side of his boot. He had been spared an agonizing, certain death by a quarter inch of leather. Chapter 14. Twitching Through the Woods. After 3 days on the River of Doubt, not one of the men in the expedition would have disputed Rondon's choice of name for this winding, enigmatic river. Not only did it continue to keep its ultimate destination a mystery, but it defied even the most experienced rivermen among them to predict where it would take them in the course of a single day. The number of twists and turns and doublings back and forth of the river were almost incredible, Cherry wrote. As far as the men could see, the River of Doubt had only one virtue. It was as placid as a lowland stream. It moved just quickly enough to relieve the paddlers of some of their work, but it rarely showed any more signs of life than a gentle current that rocked their canoes like a hand on a cradle. When they set off on the morning of March the 2nd, the river was reassuringly familiar, lazily spreading through the forest and carrying them in a northwesterly direction. By the middle of the afternoon, however, the paddlers felt a subtle but disturbing change. The current had begun to quicken. Each of the Amazon's thousands of tributaries starts at a high point, either in the Andes, the Brazilian highlands, or the Guiana highlands, and then steadily loses elevation and picks up speed until it begins to approach the Amazon basin. Scientists have divided these tributaries into three broad categories: milky, black, and clear, in reference to the color that they take on while carving their way through three different types of terrain. Alfred Russel Wallace, British naturalist and friend of Henry Walter Bates and Charles Darwin, made the distinction widely known in the mid-19th century when he published his Narrative of Travels on the Amazon and Rio Negro. Wallace noted the striking difference between the milky Amazon and the black waters of the Negro, where they collide on the northern bank of the Amazon. Seen from above, the meeting of these two colossal rivers looks like black ink spilling over parchment paper. The visual effect is heightened because the Negro, which is warmer and thus lighter in weight, rides on top of the Amazon, and the rivers do not fully blend until they have traveled dozens of miles together downstream. Milky rivers, such as the Amazon and the Madeira, generally have their origins in the west and are clouded by the heavy sediment load that they carry down from the youthful Andes. Blackwater rivers, on the other hand, usually come from the ancient Guiana highlands in the north, and so wash over nutrient-poor sandy soils. Scoured by millions of years of hard rains, these soils cannot retain decomposing organic matter, mostly leaves, which, when swept into a river, literally stains the water black like tea. Although during the rainy season the River of Doubt is nearly as black as the Negro and as murky as the Amazon, it is technically a clear water river. Like the Amazon's largest clear water rivers, the Tapajós and the Xingu, it has its source in the Brazilian highlands, and so it picks up very little sediment as it flows over ancient and highly eroded soil. Clearwater rivers are also less acidic than blackwater rivers. Some, most notably the Tapajós, are so clear that they look blue, perfectly mirroring the sky above them. But most, like the River of Doubt, mix with either blackwater or milky tributaries as they snake through the rainforest, and so look neither blue nor clear by the time they reach their mouth. For Roosevelt and his men, the color of the River of Doubt was of interest primarily for what it revealed about the speed and character of its course. The same eroded crystalline plateau that kept the river largely sediment-free was also banded with alternating layers of soft young rock and hard ancient rock, each of which had been exposed by the carving force of the river, creating a perfect breeding ground for waterfalls and rapids. At around 3:30 that afternoon, the men heard a low roar that traveled upstream like distant thunder before a rainstorm. Over the ensuing weeks, this roar would become for them one of the most alarming sounds in the Amazon, the sound of rapids. With a heightened sense of expectation, they allowed themselves to be swept along on the swift current until they reached the first rapid. Although lively, it was small, and the expedition's three canoes and two balsas easily bumped through its turbid water. The men's relief at having successfully navigated this first obstacle, however, was short-lived. "Instead of finding quiet waters at the foot," Cherry wrote, "the current ran faster and faster until we were whirled along as though through a mill race." Suddenly, the river made a sharp turn, and when they rounded the bend, the men saw a seething cauldron of white water, the prelude to world-class rapids. Surprised by the stark transformation of their placid river, they quickly drove their canoes ashore so that they could decide what to do next from the relative safety of the bank. It was impossible from this vantage point to tell exactly what was whipping the river into such a frenzy, but they did not want to find out while they were still in their clumsy dugouts. Leaving the camaradas behind to set about clearing a spot for their camp, the officers cut a path along the bank so that they could see for themselves what awaited them downstream. They were disheartened by what they found. Stretching before them for nearly a mile was a series of rapids that included two roughly 6-foot waterfalls. The river sped, Rondon wrote, with enormous velocity, through rocks of friable sandstone that had been deeply cut out, smashed to pieces, and thrown one on top of the other by the rushing force of the waters. Once over the falls, the river briefly divided into two branches as it swept past a small island, the last stronghold of resistance which that ruined ground offered, Rondon noted, but then came together again to perform a feat that none of them had ever expected to see. The water channel, that had been at least 100 yards wide and proportionally deep just a mile above the rapids, now churned through a passage that at one point was less than 2 yards across, transforming the quiet river into a water cannon. It seemed extraordinary, almost impossible, that so broad a river could in so short a space of time contract its dimensions to the width of the strangled channel through which it now poured its entire volume, Roosevelt marveled. In fact, so narrow was this gorge that Kermit took a picture of Cherry kneeling at its chipped and worn edge, spanning it with his rifle. "No canoe could ever live through such whirlpools," the naturalist would later write. "Only one glance at the angry waters was necessary for us to realize that a long portage would have to be made." The portage around the River of Doubt's first serious set of rapids lasted for 2.5 days. Rondon put everyone to work except Franca, the cook, and an ill camarada, who had already begun to sweat and shiver with fever. Even Kermit, who was suffering from a renewed attack of the boils that had tortured him during the overland journey, helped move their camp to the foot of the falls and, with Lyra, hauled the expedition's heaviest waterlogged dugout up from the river. It was only by applying block and tackle that the camaradas were able to get all of the dugouts out of the water, up the bank, and onto level ground. There must have been few men in the portage team who did not recall with deep regret the expedition's abandonment of Fiala's 160-pound canvas-covered canoes. The camaradas had already prepared a corduroy road of heavy logs upon which they would drag the canoes. With axes and machetes, they had hewn a rough path through the jungle's tangle of trees and snaking vines. Then they began chopping down trees, a job made infinitely more difficult by the broad, load-bearing buttresses that supported most large boles. These trees were cut into hundreds of thick 6-foot-long poles, which were placed on the ground at 2-yard intervals to serve as rollers for the unwieldy canoes. Once the road had been laid, the real work could begin. Harnessing themselves to a drag rope, the camaradas lined up, two by two, like draft horses, to pull the dugouts over the